This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first week of November, and this week, the New York Times made a lot of liberals nervous. New high-quality battleground state polls from the Times paint a picture of a close 2020 election, sending a different message from the national polling we see more often with big leads for Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. Part of the message here is that Trump's electoral college advantage appears to be widening. That is, whatever trends are happening in the suburbs that continue to weaken Republicans with part of their traditional base, that may be taking away votes in Texas or even more votes in California, but in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, those effects aren't as important. Things remain close, and you could conceivably see Donald Trump be reelected while losing the popular vote by an even wider margin than he lost last time. And that has a lot of Democrats wondering what they need to do in this primary to prevent that from happening. We're going to talk about that later today and how you should think about polls so far in advance of an election. But now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left is Sabeel Rahman of Demos. We also have a special guest today, Ariel Edwards-Levy, who is reporter and polling editor at HuffPost. Hello, everyone.
Hey, Josh.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
So there were elections on Tuesday in a few states. We can talk about 2019 elections before we turn to 2020. And Republicans did hold on to the governorship in Mississippi by about 6 points. But in Kentucky, Republican incumbent Matt Bevin lost despite a last-minute assist from President Trump, who rallied for him in the state. Andy Beshear won that election in Kentucky, succeeding where other Democrats have failed in two ways. He held on to part of the ancestral Democratic base in Appalachian Eastern Kentucky, which has otherwise swung hard toward Republicans, and he made inroads in once strongly Republican suburbs of Louisville and Cincinnati. The suburbs also delivered for Democrats in Virginia, giving the party control of both chambers of the state legislature and therefore full control of that state's government for the first time in decades. Sabeel, what lessons do you see in these results as Democrats look to next year?
So a couple things jump out. First is this is a pretty important result for the Democrats, right? You have a really important shift in Virginia. Now with the trifecta, that's going to change the politics and the policies that come out of that state. And when you compare Virginia and Kentucky, this move in the suburbs that you're describing really is a strong pattern across the different states. I will say there also is a similar move happening in rural counties, too, in the other direction. And I'm sure we'll talk about that in a moment. The other thing, though, to say is that, you know, there is a grain of salt, right? It's a 2019, it's an off-year election. It's hard to extrapolate national trends. So this isn't quite the same as the precursor to 2018, but it is a strong result for the Democrats.
Rich, when you look at Virginia, Democrats, it felt like we're having a rough year in Virginia. You know, you had the blackface scandal with the governor and the other blackface scandal with the attorney general and rape accusations against the lieutenant governor and some Democrats in that legislature and the governor staking out a position on abortion that Republicans thought was very extreme and would outrage the median voter. None of that seems to have stopped the steady forward march of Virginia becoming a blue state.
Yeah, so this is – march is the right word. It's a trend that's been going on for a long time. It has to do with demographic changes in the state becoming better educated, more suburban, more diverse. So the whole divide we're seeing now between the suburbs and more rural working class voters, it's something that's been going on for quite a long time, and Trump has just accelerated it. And he's his conduct is repellent to a lot of former Republicans in the suburbs, especially women. But the question, and we'll, I guess, address this in a little bit, is whether he can do what he did in 2016, draw a broadly a radioactive or at least easy to make radioactive opponent and take off enough of the edge in the suburbs to just barely get over the top again.
Ariel, is the national story that simple as, you know, Republicans keep doing worse in especially inner suburbs and Democrats keep doing worse in rural areas? And if that is the story, is that an even trade between the two parties?
I mean, I think that is in large part what we are seeing across the country. And, you know, I think that can obscure that there will always be things happening in a particular race, in a particular level. I mean, you saw that in Kentucky, where there were certainly considerations that were not national politics. Obviously, that's a gubernatorial race where it's a little bit of a different story in terms of how much partisanship is going to influence people's votes. But you are seeing these broader demographic trends of just these areas sorting themselves out more and more. And, you know, we'll see whether that ends up evening out and whose favor that is.
Rich, The governor, as Ariel notes, there were some specific local factors. Matt Bevin was not the best liked person, including institutionally in the Republican Party in Kentucky. He tried to defeat Mitch McConnell in a primary a few years ago. So after this close result, he lost by about 5,000 votes. He's basically said he's not going to concede. He thinks there were irregularities. He wants a re-canvass. Maybe he's going to contest the election. First of all, what do you, like, he lost. What do you make of him coming out and saying that? And then also, I mean, what do you make of the response of the Republican Party in Kentucky, which has been mostly to sort of ignore him and say, well, he lost?
The 5,000 votes is not a lot, you know, in the scheme of things, but in the recount or re-canvass scenario is huge. And the chances of overturning that are extremely minimal. It's basically impossible. So I don't like this trend. We saw Stacey Abrams do it in Georgia as well. You lost. Please be gracious about it. It's a very tough things personally. It's hard to take, but go away and don't tell us for years afterwards how you were truly the winner when clearly you weren't.
Yeah, Sabeel, I hear Democrats worrying about, you know, is Trump going to admit he lost if he loses the 2020 election? And this, you know, I've not been very worried about that for reasons that are playing out on the ground in Kentucky, which is, you know, you can say, I didn't lose. And that can be irrelevant if other people won't go along with it. And it looks to me here, you know, as Rich is noting, 5,000 votes is a lot. If it was 500 votes, we might see a different situation. But also it's parallel to Trump in that you have an executive who the other institutional elements in the party never really wanted in charge. And there's a part of them that I'm sure is just, you know, pleased to be done with Matt Bevin.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a hopeful lesson. I hope you're right, taking the model of Kentucky. I mean, look, here's the challenge in some ways, right? That the decision making factor here is going to be the rest of the institutional right, what the party thinks, right? If the party doesn't go along with it, then it just becomes sort of a slightly embarrassing, you know, stance on the part of the losing candidate, and it goes away and our democracy proceeds. And democracy only works if both sides recognize the legitimacy of the results, right? And so I think in that sense, you and Richard are right. What I worry about is when we talk about the impeachment scenarios, you know, there's such a strong incentive at the moment for the institutional power brokers of the Republican Party to sort of fall in line with the president, that's where I would put more concern, right? The president's going to do what he's going to do. He always has. But at what point does the rest of the party decide, you know what? The rules are the rules. We have we have other people we can put forward in an electoral contest, and we don't need to keep following this train.
Well, let's talk about impeachment. I think that's a good time for us to talk about impeachment. Rich, there's an article in the New York Times this week about an emerging defense that House Republicans are talking about. As it becomes clearer that there was some sort of quid pro quo here around Ukraine, Ambassador Gordon Sondland has changed his mind. He refreshed his recollection and said, oh, yeah, I did tell the Ukrainians that they would have to make this public statement about investigating the Bidens in order to get the release of the military aid. And so Republicans are talking about the possibility of saying essentially that these guys were freelancing, that, yes, somehow a message got to the Ukrainians that there was this quid pro quo, maybe Trump never authorized them to send that message. Maybe he didn't want to. After all, Trump specifically denied to Senator Ron Johnson that he had proposed a quid pro quo. And especially in the case of Rudy Giuliani, maybe he was even acting for his own independent financial interests. He had all these business interests in Ukraine. Maybe he was using his position close to the president to push his own agenda. And that's where this quid pro quo idea came from. And the president is innocent. And I think in that context, it's worth considering a tweet that Rudy Giuliani sent this week that looks outwardly like defense of the president, but I'm not sure it is. He says, "The investigation I conducted concerning 2016 Ukrainian collusion and corruption was done solely as a defense attorney to defend my client against false charges," unquote. So is it a viable defense of the president to basically throw Rudy Giuliani under the bus and say, you know, whatever these people did, the president didn't authorize them to do that? Because it certainly sounds like Giuliani is going to say, no, I did this in my capacity as the president's agent.
Yeah, so I'd say a couple things. One, you know, there's a glimmer of an opening for this defense because most of the people we've heard from so far, I guess really almost all the people we've heard from so far had what Trump was thinking in second or third hand because they weren't the insiders, which is, you know, more Bolton, Mulvaney, Giuliani. And it's entirely plausible that Giuliani, in important respects, was freelancing, but I think that would have to do more with his business dealings in Ukraine. So it's just hard to believe that these guys got this cooked up this idea on their own. And how did the defense aid get withheld? You know, did Gordon Sondland do that too? And Trump mentions on the call, talk to Rudy, which again is an indication that he and Rudy are on the same board. on this. So a month ago, when it was still pretty early, I had a theory that, in my defense, I offered tentatively that maybe there was the intention of the quid pro quo, and it never really got to the Ukrainians. So it's clear at least it got to the Ukrainians. And I know you're skeptic, Josh, but I still think the defense Republican senators will end up falling back on is they got the money and they didn't make a statement about investigations.
Well, so Sibyl, this is the Sideshow Bob defense, you know, the attempted murder. There's no Nobel Prize for attempted chemistry.
Right.
But that in The Simpsons, that's a joke. Like, if, you know, is it really good enough to say, well, you know, the president didn't get away with it and therefore no harm, no foul?
Yeah, I think any fifth grader recognizes just how paper thin that excuse is, you know, won't get you very far in the real world and won't get you very far here. It's not an excuse at all. Right. Of course, the point is in the attempt. And I agree with what Rich laid out. I mean, the freelancing excuse, you know, this is each week there's a new sort of angle. Right. And they all kind of keep falling down one after another, in large part because of stuff that the president and Giuliani and others keep saying on live TV and on Twitter from their own mouths. So, you know, it is kind of absurd.
So I know you hate this question, Rich, but so this still isn't impeachable. And I ask again, I want to, because of that Giuliani tweet, because one thing that we've been talking about is, you know, what exactly was Rudy's role when the president mm-hmm. says talk to Rudy? And you had said, I think accurately, you know, sometimes presidents have unofficial envoys. Right. They have people who are close to them who act as emissaries, and that is not inherently inappropriate. That's true. But again, we have Rudy Giuliani saying here that he was, quote, solely, unquote, acting as a defense attorney to Donald Trump, which is to say that, you know, whatever he was doing, he was not doing it as an unofficial envoy mm-hmm. of the United States. He was doing it as a personal attorney to Donald Trump in his personal capacity. Isn't that therefore the president using a resource of the United States government, its foreign policy, for what is explicitly a personal purpose?
Yeah.
What do you have him talk to your personal attorney about if it's right. not for a personal purpose?
Right. So again, this is my defense, and I hope it doesn't go down in the textbooks as the Lowry defense, but maybe it will. It's not just not to say it wasn't improper. It was. It's the question of the gravity of the offense and whether that justifies impeaching and removing him from office. And I do not think that outcome would be better for the country. I think it would actually make our politics worse. And it would be an injury, I think, to our politics and our institutions to not just, you know, partially undo an election, which every impeachment potentially does, not fully redo it because Pence would be the president, but to short circuit a reelection campaign that he has some significant chance of winning. It's not like he's at 20% and the country is uniformly outraged by this. And there's a consensus that it's that grave. There isn't. And in fact, there's quite a likely scenario, 40-50%, whatever it is, that he'll get impeached and get reelected.
So if the polling moved on this, if, you know, if his numbers went down into the high 20s or something and we had, you know, 60%+ for impeach and remove, would that move you?
Well, see, I think the dynamic here is if it were something much more grave, the polling would potentially move. But it's not going to move because there was not an enormous harm to the country here.
Ariel, let's talk about that that public opinion situation. We had this significant move in public opinion after the Ukraine story broke, where basically the entire anti-Trump coalition got gathered up and nearly all of them were telling pollsters, yes, we want an impeachment inquiry. Most of them are telling them, yes, we want the president removed as a result of that inquiry. Have those numbers been continuing to move, say, in the last 3 weeks? Or did we just reach a new level and then we're static at that level where, to Rich's point, it reflects the broader divide in opinion on Trump generally, and he's maintaining his whole base?
Right now, we are definitely closer to that latter scenario where we're seeing, you know, stability after a brief, very pronounced change in opinion, which I think is interesting because it tells you something about what moved public opinion on impeachment in the first place, which was that there was this development that felt, I think, legitimately enormous to the American public. And what that was, I don't even think was so much the details specifically of the Ukraine phone call as it was the Democratic Party getting into line and taking a public stance in a unified stance on the issue. And when they did that, you saw most prominently Democrats, Democratic-leaning independents, you know, following their party cues or saying, okay, the party is now pretty much unanimous that this is something that we're going to start at least pursuing an inquiry. And they followed that. And you saw this pretty dramatic uptick, especially because there are so few dramatic shifts in party politics these days. Since then, things have more or less stabilized. You see sort of consistently support in the very high 40s, maybe low 50s for, you know, impeachment removal, however you're going to ask that. And what you see when you ask about the process itself is that people generally don't tend to be thrilled about the way Democrats are handling this. They're not overwhelmingly supportive, but they give much, much worse ratings to Republicans in Congress to the way that Trump has been handling the inquiry. So things have pretty much stabilized about what you expect from almost any partisan situation in the country at this point. It doesn't look good for Trump. It's not like his numbers are going to get better on this, but it doesn't look like people have been following the latest developments very closely and, you know, reacting sequentially to each new thing that happens since that initial sort of burst of change.
Sabeel, then what are lessons for Democrats there? Because I think Rich is right as a descriptive matter, which is to say that removals from office happen when presidents' support has collapsed across the political spectrum. It doesn't have to go to zero. Nixon had 25% support when he left office. But I think it is true that the president will not be impeached and removed with an approval rating of 40%. So if Democrats' project right now is that they need to move public opinion on impeachment, what is there for them to do?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really important part of the conundrum here. I mean, first of all, the impeachment is a power of the Congress, right? It's not, strictly speaking, a power of the plebiscite or of public opinion. And so the responsibility and the decisions and opinions of Congress matters here, constitutionally as well as politically. And I think that's important because a lot of times we think about this as a question, strategic question, what should the Democrats do, which I'll come back to in a moment. But I think this is actually really a question for what is GOP leadership supposed to do, right? And what are they doing or aren't they doing? So, you know, if the whole point of having a separation of powers is to prevent the kinds of abuses of office that an autocracy or a tyranny can do, when a president can weaponize foreign policy for domestic, political, and personal gain, even if it's, you know, feels somewhat mild, that is a really dangerous door to open. And so I think the question is, you know, what is the whole Congress, including the Republicans in Congress, what is their responsibility to our constitutional system? And what's the strategic question for them, right, in this moment? So I think that's a question for both parties. To the question of what the Democrats really need to do now, I think part of what I take from the polling that Ariel was sharing is that there are very few things that punch through the noise of how people understand what's happening in Washington, right? We have sort of like default received ways of interpreting left and right. And so moving to a set of public hearings to air out in public transparently what the facts are, what the sequence of events are, why we think this might be a problem, right? That's an important next step. And then we see what happens from there. The other thing I'll also say is that there are lots of tools that Congress has at its disposal to ensure accountability of the executive branch. So I think it's a little false to say it's either impeachment or we just shrug the whole thing away. But this is why I think a lot really rides on the shoulders of the Senate leadership on the right, you know, that this is their time to step up and actually take this seriously.
I can say two things about that. One, even though I don't want to see him impeached and removed, this is a much better process than the Mueller process. My complaint about the Mueller process, it was screwy because he had the executive branch, in effect, undertaking what was a de facto impeachment inquiry against the president of the United States. And the political accountable body wasn't, you know, Democrats didn't have the House then. But they do now. But this is the way it should work. They're on the lines, and they're politically accountable for this one way or the other. And also, I just don't want my opposition to impeachment to be taken as, okay, this is no big deal. Sweep it under the rug. I'm completely fine with making a big deal of it and having hearings and having investigations and getting to the bottom of it.
Let's take a quick break. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review, Sabeel Rahman of Demos, and Ariel Edwards-Levy of Huffington Post to talk about the 2020 election picture. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Sabeel Rahman, president of Demos. And our special guest is Ariel Edwards-Levy, reporter and polling editor at HuffPost. National polling has generally showed the major Democratic candidates for president with major leads over Donald Trump. According to the Real Clear Politics average, Biden has been leading the president by 10 points, Sanders by 8 points, and Warren by 7 points. But new battleground state polling from the New York Times shows a much closer picture that has some Democrats nervous Trump could be narrowly reelected, even if he loses the national popular vote by a wider margin than last time. Ariel, before we get into these specific polls, I want to ask you a general question. Suppose that you are a Democratic voter whose top concern is defeating Donald Trump next year, and you would like to vote for whoever you think is the strongest general election candidate. What information can you look at now, a year ahead of the election, that gives you actual information about who's the strongest general election candidate?
I mean, I think the answer is, unfortunately, that if any particular Democratic voter knows the answer to this, they should probably be taking a job as a top Democratic strategist somewhere, because they will have figured out the election better than pretty much anybody else working on it. You know, I think you can look at the sort of numbers that are starting to come out. We're just sort of on the cusp of being able to start looking at these polls that are coming out and seeing, okay, maybe this does mean something. But what we're seeing a lot of is fairly close numbers for different candidates. And we don't really know yet, I think, this time around, exactly how predictive a lot of this polling is going to be, is one of the main challenges. In past elections, you've seen that polling more than a year out, about a year out, is basically not predictive of who's going to win an election. And there's a theory that this time around, because things are so much more polarized than they've been in the past, that it's going to be a little bit different. But it's still, I think, hard to be able to take a look at what we have now and say, okay, there's definitely one candidate who's going to win. And I think that's reflected in the way that Democratic voters mostly have been approaching this race. When we've done polling, we've found that the vast majority of Democrats believe that there are multiple candidates who can win against President Trump. So a lot of people are not looking at this as sort of a zero-sum game here, I don't think.
What about data other than polling data? I mean, I know one thing political scientists have looked at is, you know, is ideology and perceived ideology of candidates. And they find in governor's races that more moderate candidates do tend to outperform compared to more ideologically extreme candidates. That effect is not so large in congressional races. We don't really have enough presidential races to look at that. So when you have, you know, candidates claiming to be more electable, they won't just point to the polls. They'll say things like, well, you know, I can appeal to swing voters. I'm more moderate. My candidate is so extreme. They'll scare people off. On the flip side, you hear, well, I can motivate people ideologically. I will bring out people who otherwise wouldn't vote at all. Is there stock to put in either of those theories?
I think there is. And I think there's stock to put in both of them. And, you know, it's this sort of idea that the push-pull of the electorate is individual people, all of whom are going to think about this in very different ways. I think it is true that, you know, moderate candidates, that idea has appeal to people who are not quite as ideological, who are maybe not quite as partisan or generally involved in the electoral process. There's also the fact that there are people who are going to be motivated by a really strong message on one side or the other. And ultimately, I think that a lot of people don't necessarily think quite along those sharp lines of this person is a liberal, this person is a moderate. And, you know, you can see that become the way that a race is framed. But, you know, is Donald Trump going to run necessarily as saying my opponent is, you know, far left? And is he not going to do that for Biden versus the way that he might against someone like Sanders or Warren? So I think it really sort of depends on what the messaging of the race is.
Yeah, Sabeel, I mean, I hear a lot of people make that point that Ariel is making about, you know, well, he's going to say that about any nominee. But I part of the question is, are the voters going to believe that about any nominee? And so, as you know, I feel like these Times polls have gotten a lot of attention this week, more than a poll release usually does. And what they show, for people who haven't followed it closely, this is a poll of six states, the six states that Donald Trump won by the narrowest margins in 2016, Arizona, Florida, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And they show all three of the major candidates close. Warren is a little bit behind in five of the states. And if you took that as an exact result and extrapolated out, that would have her like just barely lose the election. Biden is ahead in five of the six states, but again, not by very much. So if you extrapolated that, he would win. But I think, you know, one message people have taken from this is, we should be nervous about Elizabeth Warren as a nominee. But another message has been that none of these three candidates looks as strong as the national polling would suggest they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think both things can be true at the same time. That one, there is cause for concern from these polls showing the strength of the president in these key battlegrounds. And two, that it actually doesn't tell us a whole lot in terms of trying to adjudicate between the front runners in the current primary. I think both of those things are true at the same time. In terms of, you know, what Democrats need to be thinking about, right? I think what Ariel was saying about the kind of voters not having a specific spectrum of like left, right, and where exactly people fall on the line. I think that's exactly true. Moderation and extremism are, they're actually kind of rhetorical battles, right? Both sides will try to paint the other person in one form or another. I think what matters more is not that, you know, we think that one candidate is more moderate because of their a specific policy proposal that they have. What's going to matter much more is having a candidate that is both seen as authentic and trustworthy on the one hand, and that is motivational, right? And that motivation can be in terms of bringing people together. It can be also in terms of addressing the things that people are really struggling with, right? And so that's part of what the different candidates are trying to prove on the in the campaign right now.
Rich, I think that these polls, they help bring into focus something the president has been doing that I think a lot of people look at and find puzzling, which is to say he sees that his road to re-election runs through the Rust Belt. He needs to win these states again that he won last time. And so as he does things that further alienate some especially affluent white voters in the suburbs, and you can look at the Texas Republican Party in basically full freakout mode. Now, they have some esoteric scandals of their own that are causing them problems, but they're worried about losing control of the state legislature. Things keep getting worse in the suburbs of Houston and Dallas. But that doesn't matter for the president. He doesn't, you know, he thinks that he's not going to lose so much ground in Texas, which he won by 9 points last time, that he'll actually manage to lose it.
Right.
If he wins Texas by 2 and he wins Pennsylvania by half a point again, he's on his way back to the White House. But it's not clear to me that that is a good situation for the Republican Party as a whole, even if the math just barely works for him.
Right. I mean, it's unprecedented. Have we ever had a president where he's got a clear, plausible path and it doesn't involve a popular vote majority, which it clearly doesn't. It'd have to be kind of an earth-shattering event for him to win more of the popular vote than a Democrat. But I think you're on to something, and it may be, you know, conventional analysts saying, oh, don't do this, don't say that. You know, most people will dislike it. Doesn't matter if most people dislike it. The potential flaw in the theory, of course, is there are suburban voters in Pennsylvania and in Michigan and Wisconsin, and they're part of the picture in those states as well. So you can't have a tsunami against you that we've seen since Trump hasn't been on the ballot in those suburbs. And another big question here is just are Trump voters, are they Republican voters, or are they just Trump voters? Some segment of them clearly are just Trump voters, and that's not good for the party either.
Can we talk a little bit about people who don't vote or people who very often don't vote? Ezra Klein said something interesting on Twitter this week, which is that he thinks that the bubble that's more important than ideological bubbles that people are in Washington is the bubble of highly informed, highly engaged voters, and that he thinks people who are highly engaged on the left understand people who are highly engaged on the right much better than they understand people who are weakly attached. And so, Ariel, I think when you look at the base of support for a candidate like Bernie Sanders, there's often an assumption that these weakly attached voters, what will bring them out and get them to vote? And Democrats particularly look at them and say, demographically, people who don't vote look like they would be more to the left than people who do vote. And so if we go out with a strong ideological message, we can activate these voters who haven't turned out in the past and get them to turn out for us. I know Nate Cohn, the who's been overseeing these polls at the New York Times, he was pouring a lot of cold water on that this week, saying that, you know, non-voters who might vote Democratic don't look like what sort of activists and Democratic Party imagine them to look like.
Yeah, well, I agree 100% with the point about trying to look at people who are not highly engaged in politics. And I think their voices, you know, maybe unsurprisingly, don't get heard. And I think that they think about politics. A lot of people think about politics in a way that's fundamentally pretty different from the way that people who are active on Twitter and who have deeply held party line political opinions think about politics. And I think the point that Nate Cohn made is, you know, regardless of what the specific, you know, horse race numbers are in one survey for people in battlegrounds, the thing that really distinguishes these people in one way, unfortunately, is that they are not ideologically cohesive the way that people who belong to one of the two major parties are. So, you know, you tell me somebody is a strong Republican or a strong Democrat, I can give you a pretty good idea without knowing anything else about them, about what they'll say on a variety of issues, which issues they'll even prioritize. But when you look at a group of non-voters who are distinguished mainly by not being an adherent to one of those parties, they often have, you know, very idiosyncratic ways of looking at politics. And I'm not sure that there's one message. You know, these are not people who are necessarily politically independent. They're not people who are moderate. They're not people who all agree on one issue. They're not centrists. They're people who have taken an approach to politics that doesn't look like the sort of two prevailing ways of looking at national partisan lines.
Sibyl, is that a challenge for a candidate like Warren? Because I think there are countervailing factors for a candidate like Bernie Sanders with that kind of group of voters. Because they say, as Ariel describes, some contradictory things, but some of the themes that Cohn describes are, you know, on some cultural issues, they tend to be more conservative than where you would expect Democratic voters to be. But they also tend to say that they really want someone who will shake up and change Washington. And in some cases, they're relatively open to more liberal economic policies like single payer. So I guess the question is, you know, Sanders can use his outsider appeal to appeal to some voters who might be alienated in general from politics. But the sort of the I have a plan approach with Warren seems like it's aimed at a voter who has a fair amount of trust in the political process, who believes that, you know, well, if we hire the right people who set out to do the right things, then the government will do good things for us, which doesn't seem like a good message for weakly attached voters. And then some of those voters will also be put off by a perception of ideological extremism.
Yeah, so I have a different read on how what the I have a plan sort of story is actually how it actually resonates with folks, right? So if we step back for a second, I mean, I think this distinction between high information and low information voters, I think, is a real one. But if you think about what gets folks motivated and mobilized to vote, right, it's not just that they're disengaged from politics. I mean, for a lot of these folks, they already know what their communities need and what they are looking for in the political system. They just don't trust the current set of politicians and institutions to deliver that. And so part of the backstory, for example, in the Virginia result a few days ago, is that you actually had a lot of door-to-door organizing among working families, among communities of color, to help kind of activate those communities and help sort of make the link that actually your vote does matter. It's not that we're trying to persuade you about something that's super ideological that you may or may not agree with already. Actually, we're trying to convince you that the things you know you want to see happen in the world can actually happen if you participate in this election and if you trust the messenger that is on the ballot. So with that lens, part of what I read both Bernie and Warren to be doing actually is making taking different tactics to try to make that case that they are change makers, they can get it done, and that they are not of the existing establishment. So Warren's I have a plan is not really, to my ears, about high information voters. It's really about let's restore our faith and trust in the fact that actually showing up to vote and participating in 2020 is going to make a difference. And here's how I'm trying to show that I can get it done.
Can we talk about Mike Bloomberg? One thing that we learned late this week is it looks like Mike Bloomberg may get into this presidential race. I think people have been talking about this a little bit wrong. It's not necessarily that he is going to run. He has been keeping open the option of running. We're coming up on the filing deadline in Alabama. If he wants the option to run, he has to file to run in Alabama, so he's filing. But certainly this doesn't mean that he's not running. He may run. Ariel, what is the theory of a Bloomberg run here? Is there a space in this primary campaign?
I think maybe the, you know, rationale for a Bloomberg run is that Bloomberg would like to be president. I don't think that what this electorate was really crying out for was more candidates to choose from. And, you know, we've sort of consistently found, if you look at polls, that people in the Democratic primary electorate are generally pretty happy with their field. Enthusiasm satisfaction is higher than it's been in past cycles at this point. You know, you see a pretty small minority who are saying, I'm not happy with the candidates who are out there, and certainly not enough for somebody to become the front runner. I guess the question then is, those people who aren't happy with the field, is what they're looking for a Michael Bloomberg sort of candidate? And do you know, I'm not really convinced there is. I'm not sure what he brings to the table that candidates within the political system, you know, people who have worked on Capitol Hill, don't bring there. And I don't think you see in the Democratic electorate a lot of people who are looking for a non-politician, for, you know, somebody who is not already represented in the field. If you're looking for someone more moderate, you have that. If you're looking for somebody who's a billionaire, we have one of those already. I don't know what niche he's targeting exactly.
So it seems to be the flirtation with this, at least, and I take your point, Josh, that people might be overselling it in terms of like he's definitely getting in. But it's clearly a symptom of the freak out among an element of the Democratic establishment and Democratic donors about the current state of the race. And here's a Democratic donor saying, you know, I'm gonna get in. And I just think Democrats are a little bit in the same stage or phase that Republicans were in 2016. We have all this young, you know, interesting, huge field. And then after a while, like, oh, they're all terrible. None of them are any good. It's not a strong field at all. And I just don't see what Bloomberg's path would be. Well, he could finish seventh in Iowa. And is he going to go, you know, and win African-American voters in the South? And it's also a bit of a misnomer. We've talked about a little bit on the program to think there's like a moderate lane. So the Biden moderate lane is made up with a very diverse coalition of African-Americans and non-college educated voters. And Bloomberg seems to me would be more of a threat to the Buttigieg lane, which is kind of relative moderation, but a lot of college educated white voters.
And that's not that many people.
Yeah, it's just baffling, right? I mean, and I think it speaks to partly the concern on the donor side that Rich was meeting. Although I would rephrase it, I think it's less about Democratic donors in general and more about a particular slice of the super wealthy who are frankly terrified of a Bernie Warren agenda. And they kind of should be, because those candidates have rightly made inequality a centerpiece of their campaign.
I think this is just a part of the ongoing erasure of Joe Biden, which is to say, you know, if you are concerned that the Democratic Party is getting too far to the left, if you're concerned specifically that they're going to come after billionaires with wealth taxes, the moderate candidate that you want to run is already not only in the race, but is leading the polls, consistently leading the polls. He's down maybe a point from where he was a couple of months ago. This idea that there's been a Joe Biden poll collapse is false. And so if you're Mike Bloomberg and you're terrified of Elizabeth Warren, either because you think she'll lose or because you think she'll win, then you should be for Joe Biden. And I think, like a lot of observers, he probably looks at Joe Biden and thinks, oh, he's lost a step. How is he going to maintain this? Blah, blah, blah. But so far, he is maintaining it. And so I would think, you know, that my assumption about why Bloomberg had been keeping his option open about whether to run was that he was watching to see if Biden would fall apart. And I sort of get that. If Biden completely fell apart, there'd be a space for Bloomberg. I still don't know what his appeal to black voters would be. But there's just no space at all with Biden still at 28. And Biden is still persistently, stubbornly at 28. And people just don't want to admit that to themselves. Yeah, so I find it crazy.
So the Biden story in a sentence is incredible resilience despite stark weaknesses. The fundraising is not front-runner fundraising. Iowa looks like a huge problem. So does New Hampshire. You know, what happens to a South Carolina strategy if that's true? And the performance ability hasn't been there. But the national polling is largely still there.
Before we go to break, Rich, can I ask you one question about Jeff Sessions?
Yeah.
So Maggie Haberman tweeted, Jeff Sessions has announced he's going to run to try to get his old Senate seat back in Alabama. The president hates Jeff Sessions' guts, blames him for all the Mueller mess. Haberman tweeted that an order's come down in the White House that people are not to comment on Jeff Sessions and this race. Is that going to hold? Is the president really going to be able to hold his tongue and not, you know, try to beat the crap out of Jeff Sessions?
If that's true, if that's the rule and it holds, Jeff Sessions will win the primary and be a senator again. But it's all, you know, it all goes to Trump. And I don't think anyone can predict. I mean, the hatred was just, from my understanding, people in meetings just radiating off Trump for Jeff Sessions, and he's not, you know, one to bite his tongue. So I you know, Jeff Sessions knows he's kind of walking on eggshells here, and a couple tweets could make all the difference in whether he gets back or not.
Yeah, Ariel, as I've watched Jeff Sessions think about this, it's like, why is he going to run into this buzzsaw? I assume there's no way to win a Republican primary like that with the president attacking you. And so is he just dependent on the forbearance of the president here?
I mean, at this point, I think, you know, in the Republican Party and people's opinions of Trump are so closely held, the never Trump part of the GOP is such a tiny sliver. And I think, you know, if you have the active antagonism of the sitting very popular within the party president, that's not a really auspicious start.
Now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Sabeel Rahman, what tweet struck you?
So Jamel Bowie of the New York Times had a tweet relating to the Bloomberg announcement, and he said, congrats to Bloomberg's various consultants for cashing in on this announcement. And I thought it was both hilarious and a little bit grim of, you know, the people who are most likely to be served by Bloomberg jumping in the race are a pretty narrow slice of folks who are advising his race rather than folks in the country.
I also have a Bloomberg tweet from my colleague Charlie Cook, who says, as a federal candidate, Michael Bloomberg viscerally annoys everyone in America in at least one important way.
Ariel Edwards-Levy, what's your tweet of the week?
I have a tweet from Aaron Blake at WashPost doing a little bit of post-election analysis. Love the day after an election, at which time everything the winner did is declared to have worked beautifully and everything the loser did to have backfired horrendously.
Matt Gaetz, the congressman from Florida, said this week the media consists of kale and quinoa eaters who look down on regular Americans who eat fried food. Laura Nelson, the transportation reporter at the Los Angeles Times, objects to this, saying, quote, "I literally once watched a journalist eat a hamburger and French fries during a press conference and then wipe his hands on the carpet," unquote. Arnold Edwards Levy, reporter and polling editor at HuffPost, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I've been talking with Sabeel Rahman of Demos and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back to talk about Rich Lowry's new book, The Case for Nationalism. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Sabeel Rahman, president of Demos. Rich Lowry has a new book out. Congratulations, Rich.
Thanks so much.
It's The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, Strong, and Free. Now, President Trump describes himself as a nationalist, but most people don't use this term positively. People to Trump's left will tell you nationalism is terminology for an exclusionary ideology that envisions an America only for some Americans, particularly one that's hostile to non-white Americans. But nationalism also has many detractors on the right, from libertarians who say it stands in the way of an emphasis on individual rights, to neoconservatives who say they think it leads to isolationism. But I think nationalism is one of these words like neoconservatism. A lot of the debates about it end up being incoherent because people mean different things when they say it. So, Rich, I think that's a good place to start with your book. What is nationalism in the American context? What exactly are you sticking up for?
Okay, so this is, I think the words patriotism and nationalism in much of the conversation, loose conversation, should be interchangeable. But people have the assumption that patriotism is everything good about national feeling and nationalism is everything bad. And I think that's wrong. Patriotism goes back to the root of the word, Latin word, patre, same as patriarchy, father, fatherland, is loyalty to your own. Nationalism, properly defined, is just strictly the idea that a people, distinct people, set aside by the common history, common culture, should govern a distinct territory.
Okay, but so what do we mean by distinct people there? Because I think what you've described there is just the nation state. I mean, obviously every country literally consists of, you know, to the extent that is democratic, is governed by the people who are citizens of that place. So what makes Americans a distinct people? Because usually, I mean, I feel like when we talk about nationalism, say in France, you think of the French nation as being something that exists prior to the French state mm-hmm. and that has been a through line through revolutions and all sorts of things. And it has to do with people who have, you know, have a cultural and ethnic heritage in the geographic region of France that goes back a very long right. time. Not all of them, but most of the people there. That doesn't apply to the United States, which is a country founded by migrants and that I think is based much more on a national idea. So who are the distinct people of the United States? Does it just refer to anyone who's a citizen?
Yeah, so I think there is an American nation prior to the American Revolution. I can't give you a date, but we are self-governing and had developed our own habits and institutions for about 100 years prior to the American Revolution, which is one reason we got an American Revolution. And we were united by common culture that involves language, which is a crucial aspect of it, involves national heroes and founding fathers, same way in other countries, involves living in a bounded and distinct territory, and also involves institutions and ideas. And one thing I spend a lot of time in the book pushing back against, I hate the cliche that you hear from both sides that America is an idea. That's just a falsehood. It slights all these other attachments that are extremely important to people as a lived reality.
Sabeel, I don't quite know what to make of this because I think in certain ways this is broad enough that you could attach any set of left or right ideas to it.
Yeah, the idea of nationalism.
Yeah, well, the idea of, you know, as you know, a country that exists for the set of people who are, you know, who are citizens of that country and who share some broadly defined set of experiences, and you could define that in different ways to accommodate the different nature of any given country. It almost seems like a concept so broad that I'm not sure it means very much.
Right. I'd agree with that, and I think there's sort of two levels that I read your argument, Rich, and we might sure. agree on some of them and disagree on others, right? One is that sort of at a very broad level, the idea that there is some kind of bond between those of us who are in a shared political enterprise, right. that is the United States of America, right? And that is a good thing because we're in a complex society, we have disagreements, we need ways to have sort of shared unity that cuts across, say, partisan lines or what have you. All good so far. But then the question becomes, well, what's the content of that shared affinity, that shared idea. And I think this is where we have a lot to wrestle with, right? Because so while it's true that there's a kind of historical line, some of the points that you're talking about, it's also true that, so many of us who feel strongly and identify as Americans and are part of this polity have a very different history, right? Coming into this country and in terms of how we've experienced American self-government or not, or the exclusion from American self-government, right? And then B, I think the other thing that is something to wrestle with is that, you know, setting aside the settler origins of the country, which has a dark side to it, of course, in terms of the colonial history of American conquest in this continent and elsewhere, there are all sorts of other powerful civic ideals that I think really do bind us together as much in their breach as in their realization, right? Ideals about freedom, about liberty, about inclusion, about democracy, right? And that's a story of American identity that at least resonates more strongly with me when I think about the struggles to overcome the legacy of slavery, integrate those of us who came here and, you know, don't genealogically come from English stock. You know, I think, you know, I'm an immigrant family and I'm the American citizen in my family and I'm quite proud of that. So I think I think the thing to wrestle with is what is that content of American identity? I think we might have some disagreements there.
Yeah. So the way I would think of it, to kind of personalize it a little bit, is you probably go anywhere around the world now and people kind of look at you the way you walk, the way you talk, what you want to eat, the way you dress, and you're American. You're like clearly an American. And not that I doubted it at all, but example I use in talks is like on the Paris Opera House steps tonight, if an African-American meets a white American and they have totally different ideologies from totally different parts of the country, they instantly have more in common than anyone around them. And that goes to the cultural core of the country. And I'm just saying that's really important too. Now, the institutions and the ideas are important as well. And I think a lot of our national identity was set by the people who settled here initially. But inherent in a lot of it, and you know, they had a very crimped view of what the nation was going to be, and a lot of them thought it was just going to be for white people. But inherent in it was a greater openness, a more open society, and slowly over time that came to be true, and that's part of our story and identity as well.
I guess then a question for you, Rich, is why in practice this ends up being controversial? And in particular, I mean, you have a political movement that Donald Trump has built around what his idea of nationalism is, that, you know, demographically looks very different in its support than the country as a whole, is much whiter. And you see a lot of suspicion from people who look at this and say that they feel excluded by it. And so is that nationalism just being done incorrectly? And if it is, does it tell you anything that, like, when nationalism happens in practice, when you get leaders like Donald Trump who call themselves nationalists, that they end up putting out divisive messages, and even when you agree with specific policies that they're proposing, using language that ends up feeling very exclusionary to much of what clearly you in your book conceive of as being parts of the American nation?
Yeah, so a couple things. Why is it controversial? It shouldn't be controversial. And it's increasingly controversial because it used to be that people with kind of cosmopolitan attitudes, they tend to be the outsiders and the critics of society. And these attitudes have now seeped into the elite of our society, in some respects, the governing institutions beginning in the 60s and the 70s. So we have, in some respects, a denationalizing elite, which is sort of an unprecedented thing in history. And just circling back to one other thing you brought up previously, nationalism, it needs some adjectives and definers, because you're right. You can have a Bernie Sanders agenda that is pretty frankly nationalistic. And over the course of his career, there have been aspects of this. You know, I cite in the book this famous interview with Ezra Klein, the editor of Vox, where Ezra in 2016 said to Senator Sanders, well, you want to help poor people. Is there anything better suited to help poor people around the world than just let even more of them in to the United States, which is a true fact. It's whatever else you think of immigration policy, it certainly helps the immigrants. And Sanders is like, no, that's a Koch brothers idea. We're a distinct country. And we got to look out for the interests of our people and our workers first. So that's a nationalist sentiment. How he exemplifies it in policy would be totally different than the way I do. But I would support the sentiment. And then to circle around to Trump, I mean, the problem with Trump is teleprompter Trump on nationalism as in so many other things, I think is unassailable. I think at times has been really moving. I think his Poland speech, which was hit a lot of nationalist themes and made the point that the Poles could never really be successfully occupied and wiped out because there's such just something so Polish about the Poles. A deeply true point. But then he gets out in the wild and on nature and on Twitter, and he totally kicks away what should be the unifying appeal of nationalism. Like a good recent example last 2 months is when he said, no human being would want to live in Baltimore. Well, human beings do live in Baltimore, and not just human beings, they're Americans, sir, and you're the head of state of the United States of America, so that should make some impression on you and lead you not to lead a certain segment of the population to think you're scorning or having contempt for them.
This is exactly where we can need to be really careful, right? I think the idea that there is an important moral political bond between folks in Baltimore and folks in Kentucky and folks in New York, right? That is important. And that is part of what makes this whole project work. But to take that bond seriously means we also have to create space for and see one another as co-equals in this American project. And that's not well served by, you know, some of the self-professed champions of certainly right-wing nationalism like the president. And so I think that, you know, insofar as we can have a useful conversation about nationalism, it really needs to be about this content of, well, who gets to be a part of the nation, right? And if the nationalism is premised on a set of traditions and legacies and ideas that, you know, celebrate the conquest and eradication of Native peoples and the periodic exclusion of immigrants of color or of descendants of slavery, that's not a nationalism,
right,
that
we should be. So I would say that the answer, though, clearly to who gets to be part of the nation, it's everyone. And the wonderful thing about true nationalism is a loyalty above tribe, sect, race, and partisanship. So properly understood, it has a great unifying appeal. And, you know, not in the Republican tradition, but just going to the Democratic tradition, because there is one, it's FDR and the New Deal. And one reason that Reagan was very fond of FDR, even when he totally turned against Democratic policies, is he remembered that nationalistic appeal, that national self-confidence, that patriotic optimism that FDR expressed during the Great Depression.
But so then there's also the question not just of who gets to be included, but who gets to benefit, right? I mean, because one thing that you talk about in the book is sort of in response to claims that, you know, nationalism in the U.S. is about centering a white culture that excludes other people. And you talk about the contributions, in fact, the disproportionate contributions of African Americans in the formation of America's shared culture. And I was struck because you were echoing arguments that we saw in the 1619 Project in the New York Times that was not very well received by people on the right, including you. And so I'm wondering what you say to African-Americans who look at that and say, yes, we did build this country together. And in fact, we did more than our share. And where has that left us? With less wealth, with less protection from the government. And so if you want to get people excited about a shared national project, don't people have valid grievances when they say, well, this shared national project hasn't worked as well,
yes,
for me as it has for some other Americans?
Yeah. So the 1619 Project, there's a lot I really disliked about it. There's a lot I think I can prove to you if we get into it that was dishonest. But what was moving in the lead essay in the series in the New York Times Magazine was this story of African-American patriotism and the essayist's father having a flag in the front yard and being at school and a teacher saying, go show on the globe what country you're from, and not knowing where to point because she's so American. And besides African Americans who've come here families come here fairly recently, besides that, most African Americans, their lineage goes way back, probably much further, as I say in the book, than any of the neo-Nazi marchers in Charlottesville. So this is a foundational sin of America, that African Americans were part of the culture and nation from the beginning and contributed so much and got so little. And I think it's it's tragic that there's a breach between the Republican Party and the African American community and conservatives and African American community. And this is something that needs to be focused on and much higher in our consciousness on the right than it has been.
Yeah, just to push on that a little bit more, I mean, I think it's not just about culture, but it's actually about the political institutions and sort of the things we most celebrate about the idea of American democracy, right? I mean, one of the parts that jumped out at me, I was thinking about the 1619 Project too, Josh, in Nicole Hannah-Jones' essay and then Jamel Bowie's essay in that project as well, there's a point made about how it is because of the blood and activism and passion of Black Americans that we even have anything resembling a democracy, right? To fight for a democracy of which Black Americans were not a part of, were explicitly cut out of in the Constitutional Convention. But then to, despite that, right, to push for a more inclusive, transformational view of what American democracy could be, you know, you go back and you look at Frederick Douglass's attempt to reinterpret the Constitution as an anti-slavery document as part of making it an argument that despite what's written in the text, the highest ideals of American democracy, as expressed in the preamble, actually require repudiation of the Three-Fifths Clause, right? And that's such a critical part, because when you think about a shared political project in which we are all a part, that means it's not just about contributions to art and culture, but actually who is pushing us to realize the best versions of our own aspirations.
There's no doubt. That is one of the glories of the American story, and I think you've stated very well.
We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Sabeel Rahman, what's your rant?
So earlier this week, Annie Lowrey had a piece in The Atlantic documenting a really important new study that came out about inflation. And on the left and the right, we usually toss inflation around back and forth when we're debating about economic policy. But this important finding is that inflation for working class and middle class Americans is actually much higher and faster than inflation for the rest of us. Because of how skewed our economy has become, prices are going up faster for those basic goods and services. This is a super wonky point, but it actually pretty radically changes everything in economic policy, and we're going to see the ripple effects of this for a number of years.
Rich Lowrey, it's your soapbox.
Yet another unfortunate, if admittedly very minor, trend in our era is the political weaponization and divisiveness around championship team visits to the White House. The latest example is the celebration of Washington national players at the White House, every moment of which was dissected by each side for plaudits and brickbats. We'd be much better off, all of us, if we could keep a sense of perspective, at least about a tradition associated with the biggest triumph of these players' sporting lives.
For my rant, we talked some last week about Elizabeth Warren's plan to pay for her Medicare for All plan. I got some more time to dig into it over the weekend. And the thing that really strikes me about it is the extent to which much of it is a Jenga tower, which is to say she needs to come up with trillions of dollars to pay for this plan. And so she's looking for where she can find it in sometimes quite clever ways, basically saying, here's money that's spent on healthcare now. I'm going to find a way to take that and put it toward the new system. But some of these are fragile. She depends on trillions of dollars in contributions from state and local governments that will face litigation. There will be questions about whether that's constitutional. The wealth tax faces significant constitutional questions. A number of these components could fall apart, not just for political reasons that I think are easy to identify. Are Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema really going to vote for all the elements of this plan? But even if they do, a lot of them end up being legally fragile. It's all built around finding a way to say that we don't have to have a middle-class tax increase in order to do this. And I just think that, you know, ultimately, in the end, if you want a really big expansion of the welfare state in the United States to look a lot more like European countries, our tax system is going to have to look like those in European countries. That means things like value-added taxes, new broad-based taxes that pay for the broadly shared services that the people who pay those taxes will benefit from. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowrey, Sabeel Rahman, and Ariel Edwards-Levy. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Colin Cab Washington and PJ Shahamat are our production assistants. Tadim Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.